Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes' Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV. We will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I will provide you with guests and information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. So now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. My guest today returns. It is Orlie Ravid, and she's a specialist in sales and film acquisition and negotiation, and she was here recently. You're going to want to go back and listen to part one. You don't have to in any particular order, but I want to make sure that you go back and listen to all the valuable information she's provided, because we're talking about how to get your film sold, how to get it acquired, how to get it to an audience, and what are the nuts and bolts of that process. So be sure to tune in. And today, if you're listening, be sure to tweet and share it and let other people know just exactly what's going on here at Rex Sykes Movie Beat. Orlie is the co-executive director of the Film Collaborative, and she works primarily on distribution, sales, licensing, and contract negotiation services with a focus on new media, digital distribution, and she also handles theatrical releases. And she's going to be coming up in just a few moments. But first, let me say thanks to all my listeners for tuning in, for the people in the chat room. That is open. If you've got questions for Orlie today, certainly you can ask questions in the chat room. We'll make sure that we try and answer those. The official website is rexsikes.com. That's my name, Rex Sykes. I'm your host at Rex Sykes Movie Beat. And Movie Beat is really designed to be a resource for you. That's why I connect you up with professionals who are making it happen. And I love you guys. I really do. I love the people in the chat room and the people who listen and the people who read the blogs, because you support filmmaking, your fans or your filmmakers yourself. You have supported my guests by retweeting about them when they're on the air, and that is just absolutely fabulous. You post it on my Facebook wall or your Facebook wall or your MySpace page or whatever it might be. Your favorite means you've emailed, you've phone called, you've shared the information, and that's important because it helps the word get out about these film professionals who are sharing their expertise with you. And they're doing it absolutely free out of their own generosity, and they're literally giving away the farm. And I am so pleased and so lucky to have Orlie as a guest today, and all the guests I've had in the past. There's over 150 some hours of interviews with professional filmmakers and TV makers and content providers, writers, producers, directors, casting agents, celebrities, actors, cinematographers, script supervisors, you know, line producers, and the like, and I will continue to bring you more, and you'll be able to connect up in that way. So be sure to spread the word and continue to do so. The official website is rexsykes.com. You can subscribe at the welcome page. The Twitter address is rexsykesmoviebt. That's Rex Sykes Movie. The last word is abbreviated BT. If you are listening live, be sure to friend us, make us a favorite, leave comments, because that helps, again, extend our reach. All of these are archived at the website in the interviews blog and in the archive section. Pay no attention to the date that you see there. Those are creation dates, not the dates that the interviews air. Just look up the guest by their name or by subject. Click on their link. It'll open a biography page, and in the biography page, it'll say to listen. Click bolded link, and you click that link, and you'll either listen live or you listen archived, or it'll download it to your computer. But the other good news is that they're all available as podcasts through the iTunes Store's app. Absolutely free. Download them to your favorite electronic device and take them with you wherever you go. Listen to them while you drive, while you jog, while you work out at the gym, while you take a walk, while you sit at the beach, while you're lying in bed. It's there for you to use and learn. And again, thanks for all your support, and thanks for sharing the news. Just a couple things in the way of announcements. I'm going to Los Angeles on the 16th of June till the 24th, I return back to the Milwaukee area. During that time, I'd like to meet my friends and business associates. I've got some business and things, so if we haven't connected yet through Facebook or email or on the phone about me coming out and looking you up, let's do so. Tonight is June 10th, and I got to tell you, tonight on Showtime, Paul Provenza's show, The Green Room, debuts And you're going to want to catch it. Set your DVR or watch it live, but capture the show, The Green Room. It's a fun show. It's worth watching. Paul's a guest. He'll be back. So watch that. While I'm gone next week, there aren't going to be any interviews. And when we come back, there'll be lots of interviews. I have not announced them. I have not let you know what they are, but you'll have to stay in touch. You'll have to keep following in order to know who's coming up right when we get back. But we've got a lot of great guests coming up. Tonight also, if you're in the Milwaukee area, you can go to the Oriental Theater at the theater. They will be screening both at 7 and 9 p.m. the 48-hour film challenge. That's filmmakers making short movies within 48 hours, producing, writing, producing, and editing, and then getting them in. I'm going to be there, so it's a chance for us to meet up if you're in my area. And lastly, and most importantly, if you're anywhere near Las Vegas, be sure to get to Kevin Servo's charity golf tournament, A World Fit for Kids. It's going on today and tomorrow in Las Vegas. Check it out at the Hot and Fun blog at recsykes.com, and that will give you the information you need to make your way over there and to help Kevin and his charity for children. All right, so without any further ado, let's bring Orly on and say hello to her and get right into this fascinating subject about how you get your film out there to audiences and how you get them sold. Orly, how are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Other than fighting a sinus infection, I'm doing well. How are you? It's good to be back.
I'm good. Thank you. It's great to have you back, and it's great to have everyone in the chat room and people who are listening. And if you're in the chat room, please be sure to follow us at Twitter and make us one of your favorites. Oh, and I should tell people, and I forgot, and that is when you subscribe to the podcast or you listen to podcasts, please go and review and rate those shows as well. Again, that helps us reach other people, makes the show more popular. Anyway, Orly, we had a fabulous conversation the last time. Some of the questions I asked you last time were, what do filmmakers need to deliver for a sale, or what makes a sale easier and appealing, or the difference that makes the difference, and then, to kind of walk us through that process. And I want to pick up today as well with these questions, as soon as I figure out what the heck I did with them.
Funny. I'll just say while you're looking, Rex, I'll just say that it was interesting because after our time together, we did a very small deal in Latin America, and all of a sudden, just realizing that Latin America, because maybe they're not all on flat screens in terms of television, that they needed to have certain deliverables that address the fact that letterbox wasn't going to work, that they really needed more that sort of square 4x3 instead of 16x9. And so it was interesting because that you don't often come up with that anymore, at least not lately in my dealings, and normally just deliver HD masters or digibetas or whatever we have. But it was funny to go, it's the world is not this, obviously we all knew that, but it was interesting just to realize in this particular deal we needed to just go back a few years before flat screens were everywhere.
Right. Well, some filmmakers, I'm aware of filmmakers who are shooting movies right now that when they started, they were shooting on 4:3, and maybe it's taken them 2-3 years they're shooting at the ratio of 4:3, and it's taken them 2 or 3 years to make their movie, and so they still have to, they can't change their format in the middle of it, so they're going to be stuck with 4:3 unless they can, convert it to 16:9, but it's nice to know that in Latin America they may have an option.
Don't worry, they won't be able to buy another house with the money, but at least it's something.
All right, well, awesome. The question that I had, on the last show, like I said, we talked about filmmakers not necessarily needing sales agents for the deals. So what kind of deals can a filmmaker broker themselves? Digital broadcast?
I mean, listen, first of all, if a film is getting offers, then obviously, if a film is in a festival setting or if a film has a lot of traction online and people are paying attention, all the studios now have people really absolutely scouring the internet and seeing what's working. And there are services that are tracking Twitter, feeds and all that sort of thing. So if a film is popping and registering all on its own, or with a little help from the filmmaker, but still making a difference without, let's say, professionals being hired to do so, And, you know, buyers will come. I mean, buyers, you know, look at the lists of the contact lists associated with any festival or any public exhibition, and you will get offers. And the question is, you know, will you be able to negotiate as well without the help? And I think the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no, because it depends on who you are, how good of a negotiator you are, how popular your film is, how popular the buyer senses your film is, or, you know, I mean, you know, also different buyers are different. Some of them are more generous and more filmmaker-friendly, and others of them are all about getting the film for as low price as they can. Buyers all talk to each other, so buyers, without you even trying, they already know that, you know, their colleagues, their peers want, not their colleagues, but their peers want the film as well. I think TV deals are probably the easiest for filmmakers to do on their own. In my experience, TV buyers tend to be, I mean, it's not that there isn't room for negotiation. It's not that the distributors don't usually get a better deal, but they do. Or I should say, if not usually, often enough that it's important to consider. You know, I guess I'm sort of talking out of both sides of my mouth at the same time, but quite deliberately, because I really think it can go both ways. I do think, though, a TV deal tends to be reasonably safe. The, you know, the question is, can you get the best fee out of that or not? But at least the deal itself, you know, will most likely be, you know, nothing treacherous. The one thing to watch out for is television stations are not stupid. I mean, they obviously have to consider internet and digital rights and then to be careful that their definitions might be more general than necessary, and you might need to get very specific and limit their, let's say, online rights to simply their own assets. You know, if it's an MTV deal, so, you know, fine, you can have it for your own site. But, you know, that there's a lot of detail that has to be resolved just on that alone. Otherwise, you will inadvertently kill off a whole lot of other distribution possibilities. Even if those other rights aren't exploited properly, you'll then be in a sort of legal jam. And these are, you know, so I guess I'm saying it's both things are true. You know, there's a level at which you can do stuff on your own, and there's a level at which you're almost certainly going to benefit from someone else's experience. It doesn't mean that you have to go to a sales agent. It means that you can, you know, if you have industry friends, consult with them. If you, you know, obviously if you want to work with a film collaborative, it couldn't be any cheaper, and there's other folks, producers, reps, whoever, people that you can talk to. I guess I like to see filmmakers just simply not give up their rights to another company all the time and sort of find that balance of doing deals directly but with some professional assistance, because it often is useful. Hope that answers the question.
No, it does. I mean, what I think of when you answer that question is the statement, you know, a fool has himself as a lawyer. The idea being that since things can be intricate and tricky, that the wisest move probably is to get sound counsel, whether that's you know, a consultant or an entertainment attorney or a friend who's absolutely well versed in this stuff. You know, you can do it yourself if you've got the time to go through the learning curve and to, you know, acquire the information that you need to in order to do it, make yourself that kind of savvy person. But if you're just and I don't mean just, but if you're a filmmaker and you don't have that distribution, sales, negotiation, acquisition expertise, you got to find it somewhere.
Yeah, and let me speak a little bit more. First of all, I didn't touch on DIY platforms. Obviously, that's something you can always do yourself as long as you have some basic understanding of what you're doing. So you can always get your film on to, you know, whether it's Fans of Film or Egg Up or whatever it's going to be, truly indie, whatever it is you're going to do DIY style. You don't need, you know, to pay a lawyer hundreds of dollars an hour for that. And obviously we're here to help people to negotiate all that much more cheaply. But I will say, I think that it's very difficult to figure out whether it is an attorney that you need or a distribution expert. And ideally you find combination. I mean, some attorneys really know their distribution stuff and some really don't. Some attorneys are just too expensive for what they're providing and some attorneys are not. And obviously we provide – actually, we're now roping in several other law firms, so we'll have a wonderful cross-section of legal service providers, and that's our goal, is to try to conflate the two services, you know, legal services with distribution expertise, so you're getting all rolled into one, and not sort of always relying on one entity that may be strong in one ways and weaker in others. You know, I think I heard through the grapevine that Peter Broderick sort of is a bit cautious about attorneys in terms of feeling comfortable just blindly, you know, not blindly, but feeling comfortable just sort of on autopilot recommending them. And I think that's wise. I think that you have to be really careful because there's just plenty of room for paying more than you're getting your money's worth, or not. I've experienced this many times. I mean, just some entertainment industries are not as experienced in distribution per se. They might be brilliant on the production side, are very useful on copyright clearance and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that, but not necessarily in distribution. So I think that's very important to be really careful and get references and know what you're looking for. You know, am I looking to, you know, get the best back end possible and be as deeply focused on that? Am I looking to isolate as many rights as possible? You know, another deal that filmmakers can do themselves but shouldn't necessarily do blindly themselves is, you know, deal with IFC. I mean, if Ariana Bacco is kind enough to want to buy your movie, then, you know, she's going to make you the offer. She's not going to, like, make you go through hoops. But it's also the case that depending on what potential your film has and what DIY activities you can pursue on your own or what rights they actually committing to exploiting or not, you will benefit from having some perspective and some assistance. And you know, the same is true for all rights deals. I mean, I have so many friends who've done deals that could have been so much better had they just – and they had lawyers, and that's what I'm talking about. So they had lawyers, and their deals were not even remotely as good as they could have been and as they would have been with either my help or somebody like me helping. So I also think it's very important to really have an intimate understanding of the very specific landscape related to your film in particular, you know, so that you're getting assistance from people who know – precisely the range of performance your kind of film can have in the marketplace, and the range of deals that the distributors you are talking to do. This is really important.
Awesome. I mean, it really is important, and you make a good argument. I mean, there's nothing worse than an attorney who can't get you what you need. I mean, when it comes down to it, whether it's in the film business or otherwise, but. So yeah, wise counsel and due diligence, you know, and make sure that you know, that you line up all your ducks in a row. I think that the wise filmmaker or the young filmmaker who is wise, you know, will seek out the appropriate counsel, like your services or others who can help them with the best deal. Well, now in terms of these, you know, there's digital and broadcast and theater, and you mentioned TV. There's non-exclusivity and streaming rights and box office splits and percentages and all that. Any particular? Oh, and one other thing that I wanted to ask is let's say I'm a young filmmaker and I decide I want to make a movie. Does it make sense for me, knowing today what you just said, that maybe the easiest deal to get is a TV deal, to think in terms of shooting for television, not only say, let's say I have nudity and violence that I shoot it, you know, in an alternative fashion so they don't have to edit as much, but I think also in terms of shooting it for the time frame of TV so they don't have to cut my stuff out, and I make sure that I have all the deliverables in an order, because I go, you know, if it's likely I can get a TV sale, but I'm not going to get a theatrical release, well, then I'm going to make a theatrical movie, but I will position it for television. Does that make sense, or do you just go ahead and make a movie and then hope that you get a deal and let them cut it up however they have to cut it up in order to put it on the air?
I don't think the latter so much, but I will say that questions like this are always really complicated, and I have, like, a couple of short answers, but before I go into them, I'll also say, you know, even people like me, I would never just answer a filmmaker and let them make that decision that is so critical without also consulting with other people, you know, that we're connected to, whether it's Ariel Veneziano, who we're working with on the foreign sales side, or, you know, and other people who, you know, do international licensing in addition to us and with us and in association with us. Or whether it's Forward Entertainment or Michael Thornton's company, whatever it is, I would consistently consult with other folks doing the day-to-day licensing of that particular kind of film to be sure that whatever answers I was giving was consistent with what's going on in the marketplace, you know, in the, you know, the present time. I mean, the short answer is, if it's a documentary, television sales are the big bread and butter for documentaries. And, yeah, you probably do want to think about the TV version. That is most likely going to be the way that you get your film distributed and make money from it and have it brought, you know, exhibited around the world. Theatrical, you know, there's a very distinct difference between the docs that, you know, sell for television and the docs that sell for theatrical. And sometimes both happen, of course. And sometimes, you know, films like We Live in Public or Gaslit or whatever are going to have a combination of theatrical and television and VOD and all that sort of thing. So I guess there are times in which the film is simply made and it gets the benefit of both. I mean, there's obviously lots of documentaries that went to Sundance that get both. Then there's also a lot of documentaries that are made as features, but they really don't, they just don't get the theatrical distribution deals. And now their only hope is to have a TV deal. And now they for them to work with a doc sales company, they're going to need to cut it down to 52 minutes. So these are the, you know, and again, there's no one right answer, but the answer is to really think long and hard about your project and to consult with folks who would, you know, really give you the most current perspective.
Well, the answer – go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and on the feature side, I mean, I don't think it really applies so much to the feature side. I mean, I think if you're making a horror film, you just make a horror film. And if you're making a romantic comedy with some cast, that you just do that. And the only thing – I will say this, though. The only thing that I will say that is really critical is for the U.S., you know, you will absolutely lose business if you all of a sudden have, you know, a ratings issue. So be careful, because it's going to be costly and annoying to deal with language or nudity or whatever. The U.S. is much more obviously challenging than the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the Western world.
I remember being in Hollywood at one time. It was like cool to make an R-rated movie. I mean, that's what you wanted to be able to make. Now, you really don't want to go past the PG-13. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I mean, listen, I distributed Besmois, and I learned the hard way that, you know, that, I mean, I didn't make the movie, Wild Bunch, they were the sales company for it, but that film literally lost, like, so much distribution potential, as well as it did, it lost so much distribution potential because of the content. And even a film like Hollywood Jatem, which, you know, we're very fond of, and we've worked with those filmmakers, and it's done very well, but it also had some struggles. They had to cut some stuff out, and, you know, to get it onto cable VOD, and not every platform took it, and, you know, and so as well as it's done, it was a little bit challenged. And at the same time, the director made the film he wanted to make. He made it open with black and white sequence, which is beautiful and very cool and very arty and fabulous. At the same time, mainstream America doesn't quite get it, and it's a little bit of a challenge on the television side and on the VOD side. And it also had, like, a moment of, you know, penile imagery, and that hurt it a little bit. That made it harder. Sorry.
I've never quite heard it put that way, but that's interesting. No, that's fine. That's fine. So, yeah, you know, I guess my way of thinking has been, you know, be an artist, be a true artist, but be an artist within the confines of commercial practicality. In other words, if you're a new filmmaker and you want to get your film made, then don't fight against the current. Don't go against the stream. I don't mean that in terms of your artistic endeavor, but do everything you can to fit within the parameters that are defined so that you can get an audience, so that you can build a name, so that you can get your work out there, so that you're ultimately you can be the maverick you want to be. Some people may think of that as being a sellout, that you have to be artistically true to oneself and screw them all if they don't like it. I tend to think make what the market buys. You know, in other words, like if I were manufacturing shoes, I'd want to manufacture an artistically beautiful, functional pair of shoes that everyone wanted to have. And then once I've captured, you know, the lion's share of the market, I could be more experimental. I could be, and by that I don't mean experimental film, but I just be I can experiment with my own, you know, artistic license and see if I'm still successful or not. But I think it's always easiest to take the path of least resistance and rely on wise counsel and follow a formula for success without copying anything, if that makes sense. You know, copy the business practices so that you succeed, but make you know, your film, you know, not a clone.
It makes sense to me, but I'm also going to say if you're, you know, Cam Archer or Harmony Korine or whatever, and you're that kind of artist, or obviously if you're Banksy, whatever, you know, you're going to do exactly what you want to do,
right.
And it's going to find its audience, and you're not going to care, and you're not about money, and, you know, and nor should you be, and I would never want, my God, I mean, not only would I never want to squelch those folks, but I would never, they would never go for it. I mean, so, you know, I think you also have to know which kind of filmmaker you are and how envelope pushing you are. And it could also go, you know, a lot of things that, you know, were once on the fringe and on the edge became mainstream, you know, Radiohead or punk, whatever it is. I mean, so in culture, it also goes the opposite direction. You can be, you know, your wild visionary, and all of a sudden, after enough time, and you're hip and you're on the fringes, and then you're a trendsetter, and then you, then the mainstream follows you, and then Target's making, you know, imitation, whatever, of your work for the mainstream. But I mean, you also have to be okay with it not working out that way. That, you know, if you're gonna make, I mean, that, but you know, we're not talking, I mean, this radio show isn't for the experimental art filmmaker, I don't think, because those folks are doing what they want to do, and they're, it's a very different thing. They're not making movies, they're making art pieces, and in a way. So, and they're not really particularly worried about linear narrative or, you know, traditional. I mean, so, and they'll still get distribution. I mean, so, and, you know, sometimes. So, or many times, actually. So, I think you can, I think in that way you can go both ways. But if you're in the middle, I guess your comment to me really speaks to anyone in the middle. If you're in the middle and you're trying to make a movie, or, you know, a film with a conventional story, narrative, or in any way just a film that has the hopes of traditional distribution, and yet you're going to try to break all the rules or not pay attention to the way things should need to go for you to enable yourself of that, then you're going to have a problem. Then you're going to be in for some rude awakenings, and you're not going to have achieved your goal.
Well, that makes sense, and I guess it always helps if you first define who you are as a filmmaker and what your goal is and what you want to accomplish, and then based on that, determine the strategy for how you're going to accomplish it.
Yeah, exactly.
And the same would be true then in distribution. Let me ask you, how much is all this going to cost? You know, I know it's different for everything, but what should somebody reasonably expect, you know, in terms of marketing, PR, consultation fees? You know, you charge a certain amount. People in the chat room are going, so what would it cost me if I went to the Film Collaborative? But I don't know if that's a fair question for you or not. You know, because I know everything is different. Okay.
No. It's an easy question, and I'll also address publicist costs because we're not publicists. But the Film Collaborative is super easy. First of all the pricing is on the website under the services menu and also under the join page. So if you want to talk to us for a year, it's $350 per project. So you've got a movie, you want to be able to pick up the phone or email and chit-chat about it, it's $350.
Okay.
And then if you want the contract services, you want us to help you, like a deal came to you, but you want us to negotiate the deal for you and do the legal work with you, then it's $500 flat fee. If we're in the position of actually playing the role of your sales agent or producer's rep, if we're actually doing the work of shopping your film and you know, all that stuff, that's a much longer process, much harder work. The highest amount of the commission we take is 15%, 1.5, but we go down to 3%, and that's all about, like, you know, if it's a bigger movie and it's going to get six figures, we don't need to take 15%. We can also take a flat fee, and some of that stuff becomes a little bit of like an a la carte or, you know, per project kind of analysis. But we really, at the end of the day, we want you to feel really good about it, and so we'll do a deal that feels good to you. And I have never been, no filmmaker has ever tried to do a deal with us that felt terrible. You know, they're always like, they want us to feel okay too. So it's very much like that. And you can also cancel anytime. The only thing we don't want to do is lose money. We don't want to have spent, and we are spending money to help filmmakers complete their films or get it out there or putting assets on our site. And now we're actually, instead of mailing out screeners, we're going to, you know, have films available in a protected way on our site for programmers. You know, those things cost a little bit of money, $100 here, $100 there. We just want to recoup those things. We don't want to lose money, let's put it that way. And, you know, we're starting to get funding, but we're waiting on the one grant to come in, and we've got our first little sponsor, you know, for our party at LAFF. But until more of that stuff happens, and, you know, it's just the beginning, we also need to just be extra careful, because I don't want to have to close our doors before we complete our mission. That makes
right,
sense.
Right. No, that does make sense. That does. Well, let me take a short break here, and then we'll come back because we are at that halfway point, and I'm just going to tell the audience that they are listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat. The official web address is rexsikes.com. And we appreciate all of your comments and your support about blogs, articles, and conversations. Also, if you have questions for future guests, you know, whenever, you know, you've got the announcement, you know who's coming up, and you want to ask a question, and you may not be able to make it into the chat room or whatever, but just put the name of the guest in an email header and the questions in the body of the letter, contact me through the website, send it off, and then when the guest comes up, I'll make it a point of trying to ask that question live so that when you listen to this podcast or an archived show, then you'll have your question answered. I mean, it's the least I can do for your support. But let me also mention that I am going to be in L.A. The 16th through the 23rd. So during that time, there are no live shows occurring. I may blog on the Rex's Rants a little bit when I can, but there's not going to be any live shows. Use that time to go in and listen to all the other interviews that you haven't yet caught up on, and you'll be glad you did. And then when we come back, we'll announce the schedule of upcoming guests, and we'll continue with the process. And again, I thank you for your support and for your interest and for listening in all the various ways that you do. So thank you. All righty. Well, let me ask you this, Orly. I mean, that was
good. I have to say, I forgot to mention the publicist, so I should also do that.
Oh, yeah,
go ahead.
Yep, go for it.
I mean, there's so many good publicity firms, and some of them are, you know, cheaper than others. But in essence, I mean, a lot of them really want, you know, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month for work. Some of them will do $3,000, and some of them will just do, you know, a flat fee of $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. It depends. But, I mean, publicity really is critical. You know, and I mean, we work with Sherry Kendler on a lot of marketing and publicity, and there's lots of other firms that we're also working with, and Mickey Cottrell and NPRM and John Murphy and Wellington Loves 15 Minutes and all sorts of interesting, and 42 West. And, you know, there's plenty of interesting publicity firms, and it's very important if you're in the process of distributing your film yourself, you've got, you know, you've, or you're really trying to go for getting the best deal possible and you want to, like, get that extra push in the press and in the trades before, you know, so the buyers can know about your film. I think you got to cough it up a little bit for that, and we don't do that, and we never will, because that's its own game. And we you know, we do recommend that you think carefully about whom to work with and hire a publicist.
All right. So the question that I have is, how much is a reasonable cap on marketing cost a filmmaker should ask for from a theatrical distributor? You know, or from a sales agent.
Oh.
Let's try that one.
That's a great question. Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, it's so painful to see, you know, to and you hear these stories at the studios, like they never pay overages because there's always the expenses being recouped. It depends on what's happening for your release. I mean, obviously, if you're doing an all rights deal and there's a big theatrical and there's a big P&A expense, well, that whole thing is going to be recouped. And I mean, you know, if it could be millions of dollars, or it could be $150,000, or it could be $50,000. So the first thing you need to do is know what the distributor is committing to. And whatever they're committing to verbally, they need to commit to in writing. And not only do they need to commit to it in writing, but you need to work out that you get out of that deal if they don't honor it, as opposed to having to take them to court because it's too expensive. And then it's a question of, depending on what they're committing to. So if it's a theatrical release, it's going to be more expensive. If it's just a DVD release, you know, it could be a $30,000 cap, it could be a $70,000 cap, it could be a $100,000 cap, depending on who's doing the release, what kind of film, and how much both trade marketing and consumer marketing there is. You may, like we're in a situation where there's a combination of the distributor doing some marketing, and then also the filmmaker and I are working on some other marketing initiatives. You know, we have a marketing services menu on our site that, you know, the lowest price is $175, and we just tell you what to do, obviously tailor, you know, custom to your movie. Or, you know, it could go up to $10,000 if you're working with us, and we're working with LBI, which is formerly Special Ops, and if you're working with us and Sherry Kendler. Like, if you're actually needing to supplement your distributor's efforts in a reasonably priced manner. But, you know, the agencies that do online marketing cost money, and obviously any sort of traditional media costs money. So it is important to figure out very clearly, okay, what's my distributor doing for me? What's the reasonable cap based on what they're doing? And what do I need to do myself to supplement that if I have any incentive to do so? You know, let's say they're letting you sell off your own site, or they're doing an affiliate program with you where you're getting, you know, extra money for any referrals that come off of your site to theirs or to Amazon or anything like that. So, I mean, there's no – it's really the sales agent. Wow, if you don't have cost cap, you're going to be screwed. And I've seen sales agent contracts that ask for $250,000 in expenses to be capped and, I mean, to be allowed for, and I don't really understand that, unless your film is that big. And if your film is that big, you probably don't need my help. So you got to be really careful about that. I mean, it's interesting with a sales agent scenario, because I don't want to sort of just, I mean, we are working with Ariel Veneziano, and there's a way in which he's a very traditional sales agent, and he has to be. You know, part of the reason they do have a function is that they are traveling to all these markets. They are interfacing with all these buyers regularly. You know, it is very expensive. So there's a balance between acknowledging that and also at the same time not letting them write off parties against your film, even if it's your own party, unless it's what you want, you know. Not letting them go to market with too few films such that it's not amortized properly, because that's another problem that you'll have. So I think, again, this is where you got to really just sort of ask a lot of questions and just get a little extra perspective from other people who have either worked with the sales agent or people who have films like your film, because I cannot give you the precise, perfect answer right now and have it and know that it's correct without it being a little bit more particular.
No, I understand that, and I can appreciate it. I mean, there's not a single dollar figure for everything that's out there because there's too many variables. Let's go back, though, to the question that I asked you originally. You know, what kind of deals can a filmmaker broker themselves? There's digital, there's broadcast, there's theatrical. Now, what kinds of things can they reasonably ask for? We talked a little bit about capping the PR and marketing costs, but now in this kind, for non-exclusivity, you know, can they ask for that for themselves? Can they ask for streaming rights, like in the case of TV, I think we discussed, or box office split? And if they did ask for box office split, like what would make sense? I mean, again, understanding that there are variables, what kind of percentage should they ask for? And then lastly, if we can bundle this question then, what absolute red flag is there that a newbie filmmaker should notice in a sales agent or a distributor agreement? I mean, when they're signing, what's the thing that they go, okay, this is a red flag, I get it, this is not cool, I need to either get counsel or I need to get out of this situation or whatever before I sign anything?
Oh, that's a really good question. All right.
And I've got one in the, and if I can bundle it further, I've got one in the chat room that says, and how does a newbie find out what's reasonable? I mean, in other words, how do they investigate and find out what reasonable costs they could, assume, or what's reasonable in terms of the rights that they can maintain for themselves?
These questions are all really, really important. And again, you know, I'm going to give the best answer I can give, and also say, though, that it's always particular to the time and the film.
Right.
But, I mean, the first thing one has to do is get the distributor to say themselves what the potential is. So what are your projections? What are they based on? Start doing the math in that way, okay? And obviously start to compare notes. What references can you provide to me of other films that you've done business with to see where the money really came from? I just heard a very painful story, and I'm not going to name names because I don't want to trash a company right now.
Right.
But a painful story where the filmmaker actually was told to go to us. They didn't until after this deal was done. They went to us for all the other deals. And the deal that they did, the distributor said, we're taking a big fee on digital, even though we're also working with a studio, so we're not doing the digital ourselves. But don't worry, most of the sales are DVD. And amazingly, you know, DVD's on the decline. Blockbuster didn't take the film. Hollywood doesn't exist, whatever. You know, DVD was way lower sales than they expected. The studio doing the digital didn't get the film onto any cable VOD platforms, not onto iTunes either. Then the film was available for streaming for $2 or $3 on Amazon in poor quality. And meanwhile, all the other distributors in all the other territories are doing very well, but this territory being the biggest, the United States of America, is really subpar for what this film's potential is. And now the film's been pirated everywhere, and in fact that's where they got the anti-piracy service that then became our more recent sponsor. But like, these stories are horrible, and this would have never happened to them had I helped them. And you know, the point is to ask yourself first to get the distributor to talk about everything they think they can do for you, then to start doing the math on what that looks like, including you've got to figure out which rights are they completely exploiting and which they're not. And all the deals that we do, we're very clear, you know. I mean, we're doing very traditional deals too sometimes. It can't be helped. If a filmmaker wants the money up front and they just want to have their film distributed around the world, we're going to have to license rights, and there's no distributor on the planet who doesn't want digital rights. They'd be insane not to. But we have very clear guidelines where if they don't exploit, you know, those rights in a proper way, the rights revert back, including down to the platform. So if you don't get the film onto any key platforms, we have the right to do it ourselves, period, the end of story. And no distributor says no to me on that because they have no choice. Like, we cannot do deals that are dangerous for filmmakers. And in a world where DVD's on the way out and digital's on the way in, or already in and on the way up, that's the only way to go. Otherwise, otherwise you're going to walk away with your film being out of your hands for 10 or 20 years, and you're going to hate yourself. So those are some of the things you can do in terms of box office splits. I would recommend that you do it based on gross, you know, points, bumps on gross, because that's a very verifiable thing, even though, I mean, supposedly theaters can lie, but most of the stuff is automated these days, and I think it generally works out. If you're doing it based on film rental, make sure your distributor is settling well with the theater. Some settle better than others. And obviously, it's always a question of figuring out the cost and making sure that you really know not only that those costs are capped, you know, distribution expenses are capped, but that there's no other sneaky ways of recouping other costs, you know. And, you know, a lot of contracts have, like, interest on the MG. I mean, all sorts of things. And, again, that's why answering this question isn't, I can't teach it all to you in 5 minutes. But, I mean, these are some basic guidelines. And, again, we're always happy to – I'm always happy to give people perspective and let them just, you know, go to Indiegogo. We have 21 days left. Go to Indiegogo and just donate $10 if you just want us to answer a question or something. We just, you know, we're happy to just help. But I'd rather filmmakers take the time to be a little bit more specific in their inquiry in a way that we can best tailor the advice. Does that make sense?
Well, no. I should say yes, absolutely. And if you could teach it in 5 minutes, there'd be nobody to ever get screwed. So,
exactly. Exactly.
I mean, so I understand that it's a very complex topic, and I appreciate your input, and I understand that there are, you know, countless variables, and everything depends. But what you're doing is you're providing for the listener, for the filmmaker, for us to say, wow, you know, this is an intricate thing, and here's things I need to pay attention to, or here's things I've never considered, or here's where I need to educate myself, or here's why I need to get a consultant. So you're providing pathways for people to begin to explore that can save them lots of time, money, you know, and bad feelings down the road. So I appreciate the fact that these are, you know, complex questions with very complex answers. But don't let that stop you, you know.
Buying a house is complex too, you know,
and you wouldn't
buy a house without assistance. And in fact, you know, I bought a house and had, even with all the professionals associated, I had to sue the seller. It's like film is the most expensive art medium in the world. And if you're already going to invest so much into it of your time and someone's money or your own money, like, it doesn't make sense to not treat it as a business when it comes time to getting it out in the world.
Very aptly put. Very, very aptly put. And I hope everybody appreciates that analogy, because it is, you know, anytime you're entering into a contractual obligation with somebody, I mean, you ought to know all the ups and downs and the ins and outs and protect yourself in whatever possible way. And I think the fact that now anybody can pick up a camera, I mean, back in the old days you could pick up, you know, an 8mm camera or a super 8mm camera if you were an amateur or a budding filmmaker, and you could make movies, but it still cost because you had to develop it, and it took time because you had to send the film out. Now you can pick it up, you can shoot something, you can edit it at home, you can put it out there, you can get it up on the YouTube. And so everybody thinks, wow, you know, I'm a filmmaker, and I don't want to disparage anybody who does that, because, hey, that we all learn, we all grow, we all develop. But we're still inside a professional business. We're still inside, you know, and if you treat it as such, there are, you know, all the caveats and all the ins and outs that people need to understand so that they don't get themselves screwed or get themselves in trouble or lose the rights to their picture or blow a deal. And so I appreciate everything that you're doing and in discussing with us. Let me ask you this, because digital distribution is a hot topic in indie film right now, but most, you know, are complaining about the limited returns. Now, how long do you think, you know, it will take to ramp up, you know, until returns are comparable to DVD, and what's happening with DVDs? I mean,
well, that's a good question, a complicated question.
I was going to say, what has to happen first to make this even an option? But go ahead.
Well, first of all, it is like the Wild West. I mean, we had a meeting yesterday with Best Buy Digital, and we're doing a deal with them, and it's very interesting. The Wild West nature of everything, right? I mean, everyone in one way or another is competing for the same exact thing, which is to be the destination that people go to consume films online or to consume films in a digital manner. And you've got retailers competing like Blockbuster and Best Buy. You've got telcos competing like Verizon and AT&T. You've got obviously all the cable operators, and there's over 40 of those. Google is competing, and FCC is committed to expanding broadband, but it's going to take a while. So the DVD numbers decline, and I have lots of statistics both on the blog and both on our digital distribution guide, which I want to get to in a second because I want to make something clear to your listeners. But we have lots of statistics. I don't want to, like, go through them all. But, you know, the numbers, it's on the decline in the, you know, like, two-digit, you know, or single-digit realm. And Blu-ray is actually going up in a way. And digital's going up. But, no, I don't think digital is – obviously, digital's not at the same numbers as DVD. And, you know, there's a reason. I mean, I don't want to be a pessimist and say it'll never catch up because it may – it certainly will for a certain kind of film, for the non-long-tail film. For the long-tail film, I'm not sure. I think there will be a level of catch-up and a level of struggle. I think it could be, you know, 3, 5, or 10 years, and that's a little bit hard to judge, and I think, again, it depends on the film. Certainly, the DVD decline is swift, especially for the long-tail, and you have this sort of problem where now Netflix won't take a film for its Watch Now service unless it's on DVD. So you've got some of these hiccups that are a little bit inhibiting of some of the potential for some of the smaller films that are really at the very end of that long tail. But, you know, there's also a glut problem that, you know, only a shortage, a market shortage will address. I mean, it was almost like we need a market correction just like any other market. And when you think about, you know, the history of film, I mean, it's not, you know, it's there's a phenomenon that happened in the 80s that is why, you know, VHS, you know, there's new technology and a new buyers, and there was all this business. It wasn't so art film and indie-oriented. It was genre-oriented and action film-oriented and all that stuff. And you had the Asian market be huge. Then it collapsed. Then in the 90s, you had this really interesting, sexy indie film business come up, and you had all these companies overpaying. And, you know, a lot of them, the word overpaid, because a lot of those deals and a lot of those distribution the analysis at the end of the day was in the red. I mean, it wasn't like Miramax always was in the black on everything it did. It just overpaid, and you had a certain market condition that was very filmmaker friendly, and you could make a movie for $100,000 and sell it for $1 million if you had John Swoss as your lawyer at Sundance. But that may never happen again, partly because there's an enormous supply, and there's still, especially if in America, there's still a very particular public that we have here. And there was an article in The Economist, and I think I might have referenced it last time, and it is on one of my blogs, that talked about actually the longer the tail is, the more that just bolsters the blockbuster films because there's so much. And so, you know, I think if internet I should say when, because this will happen, when internet gets better and better at helping people find what they want, and when you have sort of personal algorithms that are working, or algorithms that have a personal taste mechanism to really drive you to the content that you're going to be interested in. This is sort of the way Netflix works, but when that works sort of ubiquitously, you know, when all the platforms have sophisticated technology like that, then it might help the long tail films. A lot of these platforms, though, don't have the marketing resources to get enough audiences to pay attention. So, you know, then it's a question of are there going to be enough platforms committed to enough long-tail films to make a difference? Are they going to allocate enough marketing energy to get audiences into those films? Are you going to have, as the filmmaker, going to have to do, and I believe the filmmaker is going to have to do more and more of that to build their own audiences, and there are audiences for these films. It's just, it takes a lot more effort, and it takes a lot more sort of grassroots targeted effort to get those audiences where you sort of build your own platform, your own brand, and that's really our goal, is to help filmmakers be their own brands and be their own platforms in combination with ours and in combination with the sort of greatest revenue-generating platforms in the digital space, which obviously is, you know, up for debate and sort of changing. But I think it's not going to be easy, and it's very technology-dependent, and it's very resource-dependent. I mean, it takes resources of time and money. And then it's a question of the public. I mean, if the people who want subscribers to auteurs, or, you know, who watch movies on auteurs, are very particular people who are very interested in art film. They're the same people who bought Criterion Collection DVDs. But that's not like 40 million people in this country. You know, the Netflix subscribers are, what they're, you know, over 7 million, wherever they're at right now. That's not the whole country. That's not the whole 300 million. You know, the majority of the whole 300 million is unfortunately still, for better or for worse, more often than not, paying attention to only a top kind of blockbuster film. And I think that's the struggle that filmmakers face. It just means a little bit more sweat equity. And again, when you're making your movie, carve out some of the budget or raise a little extra to facilitate the marketing of your movie, to build your own audience, to do that community building. It's the only way that you're sure to find your audience. If you made your film for yourself and for your own sensibility of who would want to see it, there is an audience there, but it's not necessarily going to find you. I'm interested to see what the Lance Wilers of the world bring to the table on the technology side. I mean, in terms of, helping filmmakers be as connected to new technology that will help them galvanize their audiences. And I think that this is an interesting time. There's all sorts of theories and all sorts of discussions and a bunch of good case studies, but also plenty of not good case. There are plenty of case studies where filmmakers have made a profit, like Age of Stupid, and there are other case studies, which I won't mention names, where even in a year from now, the filmmaker will have barely recouped and not made a profit, right? But they also have another agenda. They have the agenda of, hey, I just want to, have gotten my film out there, and I just want to get investors comfortable enough to finance my next film, and that works for them. But that also means a lot of sweat equity, a lot of your own time. So I've rambled a bit, and I said I had a sinus infection, so I hope everyone forgives me. But I hope that it's a little bit helpful.
Great. You're doing great, Nat. And let me two things. One is when I listen to you talk about, what it takes nowadays, I'm reminded of the Hillary Clinton comment that it takes a village, and that was obviously for something else. But when it comes to making movies today, it takes a village. It takes all sorts of people that, from beginning to end, and afterwards to market your film, and the wise filmmaker assembles that village early on and gets it out there. But that's just my comment. Let me ask you to clarify something for the listeners who may not be in the chat room or who are listening to this at another time. A long-tailed film. Oh, and by the way, we got about 6 minutes left, just so you know. But long-tailed film, the concept of long-tailed film, what does it mean?
Oh, I mean, it's just, the fact that these are films that are kind of evergreen, but they're also not blockbusters. They're films that have their own, audience, their own maybe. It was a term that Chris Anderson of Wired had coined a long time ago. But when I'm referring to it, it's sort of like the films that are on Netflix that are part of like a library of catalog, or they're smaller films that have an audience, but it's more boutique, it's more cottage. It's not the big blockbusters that, it's more niche. It's more the unique. They're going to sell in small quantities over a long period of time, not huge quantities in the short term. So it's the sort of opposite paradigm of the blockbuster. Does that make sense?
Makes sense.
Yeah. Let me say something. The term was coined in 2004, just so you know. But let me just say, I mentioned the Digital Distribution Guide, and I want to say that I don't want people to get frustrated when they try to go to it and they can't access it. So, the Film Collaborative has a tab called Distropedia, and you can link to the Digital Distribution Guide through that, or you can just go to digitaldistributionguide.com. But we do have it sort of locked for members. And you may not want to join us for $100 to access it, because for whatever reason you just can't deal. And if that's the case, all I ask in good faith, if you want to check it out, and if you want to, access us for information, I would just love, we have 21 days left on Indiegogo, just donate whatever you can and let us know you've done it, and we'll give you that access. This is like a Rex Sykes limited offer, but I just, I don't want us to be in the position of always doing it for free. We just ask for whatever you can do. I don't care. Is that fair? I mean, it is under lock and key, though. I'll tell you why, because a lot of for-profit distributors were going on and just using information, and it's taken us a long time to amass, and it takes us resources to update, and we just want to, not just give it away to those guys.
Well, no, and that's great, and I appreciate you making it a Rex Sykes Movie Beat offer, a limited-time offer for listeners who tune in, who would be wise to take advantage of it. So thanks. That's great. I appreciate that very much. Thank you. On behalf of my listeners and myself, obviously. We have literally about 3 minutes left. Should, you know, DVDs, there was a moment where you said something about, the DVD market is shrinking, I guess, and I want to make sure I quote you right, but I mean, you know, it's not where it was before, but then you said Netflix still requires you to have a DVD. Is when we say DVD, are we talking the equivalent of Blu-ray? Blu-ray is still DVD, it's just a different platform, or are we talking about the tangible hard disc, whether it's Blu-ray or DVD, that is going away and that everything's going to become streaming or.
No, you're right to ask the question. I actually, the analyses that are, sort of public in the video industry or the home video industry are sort of talking about Blu-ray as separate. So the Blu-ray sales were actually rising. You know, they were actually up 74% in 2010. But that's also relative to Blu-ray. That's just specific to Blu-ray. So actually, Blu-ray sales are increasing, and some of the deals that we're doing, the distributors are in Europe are doing Blu-rays, and that's a revenue stream. And I think that's an important potential that's positive. The regular DVD sales, of course, they're going down. They're only going to go down. They're never going to go back up, partly because all the retail chains are going out of business or closing their some of their stores, and certainly, their shelf space is going, Best Buy's shelf space is going down 19%. Obviously, we know what's happening with Blockbuster. It's shutting its stores, a lot of them, and Hollywood Video is gone, and Movie Gallery closed. So, I mean, the distributors can't keep selling more units when there's fewer places to sell them, but there are still mom-and-pop shops, and there are still the 2020s, last I heard, and there is still Netflix, of course. And there is Walmart, but Walmart's not going to take every film. So right. DVD sales are going down because of that, because of the fact that a lot of the retail space is going away, the retail buying. And the retail buyers that are still buying are focused on not the long tail, but the blockbusters.
It is a complicated business, that is for sure. You know what, Arlie, we are out of time. And before we are absolutely out of time, I want to give you again the final word. But that'll be for all of maybe a minute, but I want to tell our listeners and the people in the chat room and the people who are listening to this archived first podcast that you will return. We will have you back later in the summer after I return from Los Angeles, and we can continue this discussion. There certainly is a whole lot more, and as you mentioned in, I believe, the first interview, it's always changing, and so we have plenty to talk about. I just want to say thank you so much. This has been fabulous. And I've taken up about 30 of your seconds of your minute. So please, I just say thank you, and any final thought?
Well, to clarify, with Netflix, what I meant was they won't put your film on Watch Now and Watch Instantly unless it has a DVD release and unless it's already in their system. And that's a very specific thing we could address. If you ever need more information about that, let me know. And the only other thing I want to say on a positive note, filmmakers always amaze me. They always manage to do whatever seemed impossible. They always manage to galvanize a greater audience than one could ever have thought about and sell their film, and there's always a way. Just think about it ahead of time. That's all I ask.
Well, that is fabulous, Arlie. Thanks so much for being here again today. Have a great rest of the week and a fabulous weekend. Feel better and let that infection clear up. And to all my guests and listeners in the chat room, thanks so much for being with us live today and for participating in the chat room. Please continue to spread the word about Rex Sykes Movie Beat to your friends and your industry connections and your associates through your favorite means, whether that's posting on your Facebook wall or MySpace page or on mine or tweeting about it, retweeting my tweets. Just be sure to help spread the word. Let the voices of these experts get to more people, more filmmakers. Let's blast the airwaves so that people can take advantage of the incredible insights and suggestions and tips that guests like Arlie and others provide. And now, while I'm gone, you go ahead and you go back and listen to the 150-some hours. That will take you about 7 days, I believe. So when I'm in California for 7 days, you could start listening. When I get back, we'll catch up. We'll find out how many of the – if you listen nonstop for 7 days, how many of the interviews you actually get through. Of course, I'm kidding, but it would be worthwhile, believe me. Again, thanks to Arlie Ravid and the Film Collective. The Film Collaborative. Let me make sure I got the right thing here. And if I've misspoken, it's thefilmcollaborative.org. I want to make sure that I have that. And if I've misspoken, I am sincerely sorry. But we've got many more exciting guests coming up in the future after I return. You can become a member of the Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends page by searching for it there at Facebook. Everybody have a fabulous day. Make your movies and complete your projects. And until we meet the next time, that will be a wrap. But before we make it a wrap, I want to see if I can make sure I've got the right name here. And it is thefilmcollaborative.org. Okay, everybody, that's a wrap.